This is the Country Hour with Megan Hughes on ABC Radio Queensland.
Good afternoon. Thank you for your company. I'll take you to the northwest shortly, where hundreds of cattle have been released from flooded paddocks. But first, here's an update on the weather warnings. So there are multiple flood warnings current, including a major flood warning for the Flinders River, with major flooding continuing at Richmond and at Walker's Bend, and that will continue for several days. There are also moderate flood warnings for the Western, Herbert, Norman and Georgina rivers, as well as minor and general flood warnings covering several other river systems. And a broad flood watch continues for the northeast Queensland coast, with heavy rain expected to redevelop between Cairns and Proserpine in coming days, with potential tropical lows developing in the Coral Sea and also the Gulf of Carpentaria. I'll have more on the weather and flooding when the Bureau of Meteorology joins me later in the program. Now to the northwest, where highways have begun to reopen, allowing weary travellers delayed or stuck after Christmas holidays to finally make their way back west. But it's not just held up freight that drivers need to watch for on the road. Around Richmond, hundreds of cattle have been released from flooded paddocks, giving the mud-soaked animals some relief from the wet. And with more weather potentially on the way as a low forms off the east coast, graziers in the region are understandably worried. Cody Rogers has been coordinating hay bale drops to properties around Julia Creek, one of the hardest hit areas, while his family's property, Wyangri, near Richmond, is also flooded. He spoke with Zara Margolis.
We got a tributary that sort of runs, it's an overflow out of the Flinders River. Our boundary sort of runs parallel with the Flinders River there for, I don't know, 30K, I suppose. And one, the Chatfield Creek, it's called. I think there's photos on the Richmond website you'll be able to get of the creek, but it's an overflow out of the Flinders River and it's come up really big and got some cattle trapped in it. But I haven't been there, I'm just talking to my brother and my dad, but they managed to get most of them out, but it's the cattle that are just out on even our high country now. It's the same for everyone, so it's just getting, this event's getting a bit drawn out. The sun's been out for 2 days, which is great, but the cattle are just, bogging and they've just got no dry ground to stand on, and it's pretty tough work getting around in the black soil for some of them. Would be 14 days of wet black soil, I think, by now. I can't remember.
Can you explain for people on the coast who are not familiar with grazing, but the weather's gone, as you say, the sun's out. Why is there still so much concern for cattle?
They haven't been able to walk around properly for days. It's just that wet. And whilst the sun's out, it's great. They've got dry backs now. They'll be much happier. There'll be a few bits of dry ground, but just the ground is that sodden and the black soil just chops up. It gets just into a sort of a bog, really, and it's pretty tough going, even us walking around in it. You sink sort of in the real wet areas where there might be a little bit of a hollow, you can sink up to your bottom of your knee sort of thing, and everywhere else you'll be sinking at least 3 to 4 inches in. So you imagine a cow's hoof sinking into that and just being wet for days on end. They're so foot sore, and it's extremely tough going for them. Our biggest worry at the moment is they're getting weaker. It's just next event, rain event predicted for next week is a real trouble for us because, they've sort of used all their energy up to get through this one.
How worried are you about the weather event next week? It's pretty early to know exactly what will come from that, but you can assume there'll be more rain on the way somewhere.
We don't need any more for now. You don't like to say it as a grazier, but I think we've had enough for a minute. It's so early on in the wet too, Zara. This could go on for months yet, but it's hard to know exactly what's going to happen. We realise that. It's a week out, it's hard to tell, but it's fairly concerning to us to see that it's going to be coming back again in some form.
Have you lost many cattle, Cody?
Yeah, I haven't talked to Dad to get the numbers yet, but there's losses there for sure. No one's really going to know, Zara, what we've lost until we finish this year out, to be honest with you. It depends on how far cattle get washed downstream, what places they end up on, whether those places are going to be at properties, whether they're going to be able to muster sort of early on. it'll all be late mustering this year, so it'll be, we'll be, I'd like to think that we could still be getting cattle back later on in the year. Would be really nice to know that they're somewhere, but the full extent of this damage, it'll take most of the year to really unfold and see what our losses are going to be like. It's very different to, I shouldn't say it's very different, but sort of is. The cattle were stronger going into this flood, whereas in 19 they sort of all just bogged and died in big piles. A lot of cattle have washed away this time, especially, oh, that's only from my experience where I've been. So it's going to be hard to tell for a little while what exactly our losses are, but there's definitely losses.
Mayor John Waterman of the Richmond Shire has put some pretty strong messaging out telling travellers to stay safe on the roads, go slow, because fences are down and those cattle that are still going have been given access to the highway so they can have a bit of reprieve. Have you guys done that too?
Yeah, we have. I think we've got about 750 on the road at the moment, which if we hadn't put them on the road, I wouldn't like to think what might have happened to them. Their two paddocks went underwater in the last 3 days. So for us, it was a, oh, well, they're still doing it tough on the road. Don't get me wrong. They're still weak and sore from the rain. But they, yeah, we've got a fair whack of cattle out on the highway at the moment. And yeah, I suppose all I can say is just, yeah, be kind to them if you're driving through them. Don't rush them. They've had enough, the poor little buggers. Like, it's going to be a little bit frustrating for drivers. I can understand that. I drive enough. But, yeah, just go steady on them and we'll get them through it. We'll do the best we can. We've got men out there every day. We're giving them water and walking them along the road and keeping them under control. But, yeah, just be patient with us and we'll keep them ticking along.
That was Northwest grazier Cody Rogers speaking with Zara Margolis. Now, there are still a number of road closures across north and northwest Queensland where widespread flooding is continuing. So if you're driving in flood-impacted roads in the northwest, drive slow because, as you've just heard, you'll need to keep an eye out for any cattle on roads. John Wharton, Mayor of the Richmond Shire, tells Crispy and Yeomans cattle could remain on major roads for weeks.
Just want to talk about the Flinders Highway. We've opened the fences onto the Flinders Highway to allow cattle up onto the bitumen. This is going to be the case on a lot of the Flinders Highway where there's been flooding. So basically from Huon to Cloncurry, the floodgates and fences are all down and there's going to be cattle on the road and there's going to be cattle on the TMR road. There's going to be cattle along the railway line because many areas along the highway there, they were jammed up and they were dying in the paddock beside the highway. So due to the fact that the road from Richmond to Julia Creek was closed and the road from Richmond to Winton was closed, the landowners, I've told them they can open the gates and let their livestock in there to save their cattle. QR are very aware of it. QR right at this present stage are moving into Richmond to start work as soon as they can. And I think they've got a big team moving into Cloncurry. And as we do open these roads up, we need the traffic to be very aware that there are livestock along the road and to drive carefully.
John, how long do we expect cattle to be on the highway at this stage?
Well, they could be there for a month. And that's due to the fact, I mean, landholders are going to want to put them back. They don't want them run over. But they may not be able to get in to fix the fences, to fix the floodgates, and particularly on these bigger creeks and that run across the Flinders Highway. And I remember in 19, you know, there was a lot of cattle. Most of those had died along the road, and there's going to be that on too, on the railway line and on the road. But, you know, so far in the Flinders and Richmond Shire, we're not too bad. Like, we don't have any cattle that have passed on. These will all be live, but they've let them in there to get on the feed and stay on the hard ground and to give them a bit of energy and a bit of sunshine. And they're feeding them and watering them along that road. So it's just a matter, I think, Crispin, of when the landholders can get their fences fixed and get them off there. They won't want to leave them there. There's no doubt about that. But they'll make that call and we'll support them on that.
So which roads will remain closed and which will remain open at this stage?
Well, the Richmond to Winton Road is closed. Any landholders along the Richmond to Winton, which is a state control road, are opening their gates and letting cattle out onto that road. And the only vehicles on that road will be local traffic. be local Toyotas. But the Flinders Highway, basically from Huon into Cloncurry, will have cattle on it.
And if you're driving the Flinders Highway, you need to drive slow, watch for cattle.
Drive slow, yep. Huon into Richmond, Richmond to Julia Creek, and Julia Creek to Cloncurry, there will be cattle on the road. So please, drive slowly and carefully, and give those livestock a chance to recuperate, and we'll get them off the highway as soon as we can.
John Wharton, Richmond Shire Mayor, speaking with Crispian Yeomans. It is 15 minutes past 12.
On your radio, online, and on the ABC Listen app. This is the Country Hour on ABC Radio Queensland.
I have some updated figures for livestock losses across the northwest. So as of 4 o'clock yesterday afternoon, producers have reported an estimated 24,200 missing or deceased livestock. Now, these figures are preliminary and are expected to increase significantly as floodwaters recede, access to properties improves, and also further reporting occurs. So damage assessments to date also include around 1,049 kilometres of fencing and more than 1,700 kilometres of private roads that have been impacted. Now, again, as with the livestock losses, these figures represent reported impacts only, and they do not yet reflect the full scale of damage on the ground. The Department of Primary Industries understands that many producers are still dealing with immediate safety and recovery priorities. Now, the department is encouraging affected producers, so if that's you, complete the disaster impact survey when you're able to. It's to report damage and losses on your properties to build an accurate picture of the event and also support the activation of disaster relief and recovery assistance. Now, speaking of that disaster recovery funding, the state and federal governments have announced an additional $38 million yesterday. So looking at the details, $21.5 million for primary producer disaster recovery grants. You can get a grant up to $75,000, $11.5 million for critical repairs and increased flood resilience at the Cloncurry Airport, and $5 million increase to the previously announced emergency fodder package. Christy McBain is the Minister for Regional Development, Local Government and Emergency Management. She tells Barbara Miller what she saw during her visit to the region.
Yesterday I was in Cloncurry and then Julia Creek, and I've met directly with a range of primary producers and our local council in particular in regards to impacts not only to infrastructure but obviously to our primary producers. You know, there are some significant losses, and I think the big concern is that we still don't know total number of losses, because at this stage we've still got water flowing, and with the forecast looking like there'll be further rain, those numbers could increase. So it's quite precarious here, and obviously speaking to a number of those producers there, they're quite in shock, I think, and you know, they thought 2019 was, you know, kind of a once-in-a-lifetime event where there were a number of losses, and unfortunately for a number of them, it looks like there'll be similar losses or more. So that's quite concerning.
And where will that money go, the $38 million announced?
So yesterday we announced an uplift to our emergency fodder allocation. That'll go to $7 million and six different local government areas: Carpentaria, Cloncurry, Flinders, McKinlay, Richmond and Winton. We've also announced primary producer grants up to $75,000 across seven local government areas to help impacted farmers with that initial cleanup, including fence restoration and debris removal and those types of things. And those grants will be available through the Queensland Department of Primary Industries. We obviously announced a package of works for Cloncurry Airport, which has been the tarmac there ripped up because of this weather, and that's a necessary piece of infrastructure for the community. It brings in mining workers. It sees Rex Plains land, but also a number of primary producers use it for takeoff and landing, but to get in various supplies as well. So really important that we assist in getting that back up and running as soon as we can.
When he was visiting the region, the Queensland Premier David Crisafulli hit out the Bureau of Meteorology after discovering that more than 20 automatic flood monitoring stations on swelling rivers weren't or online. He said it was a matter of life and death for remote communities. Of course, there's been a lot of criticism of the BOM's new website. Is it up to the task this summer?
Yeah, look, it's really important that we get to the bottom of some of these flood gauges. A lot of them are owned by local councils and state government entities, or they're owned by private companies, but it's really important that they're online and working. That's why in the 2023-24 budget, our government allocated over $200 million to upgrade and maintain a number of flood gauges across the country. I think it's really important for communities that there is a single owner and someone that, you know, can monitor that they are working and the community can rely on them. We've already, through an $8 million package, upgraded about 180 rain gauges, flood gauges and rain towers across North Queensland and Northwest Queensland with the former Queensland government. But it's really important these things are maintained and kept up to date. I know that it is really important for people to have access to accurate information as soon as possible. So we're doing some work on that already.
But is the BOM fit for purpose? You've flagged that there does need to be a change in the culture and the approach of the organisation.
Oh, look, I think that the Bureau are doing a really complex job. You know, I spoke to a number of primary producers yesterday who were relying on the information that BOM was sending out, and they appreciated that information and believed it helped them move livestock quicker than they would have been able to otherwise.
You don't have concerns about the BOM website?
I think there's always ways in which we can look at improving things, and I think my colleague, the Minister for Environment's been really clear with BOM that the expectation in our community is that they want to be able to rely on that website, and that's been relayed to BOM as well.
Kristy McBain is the Minister for Regional Development, Local Government and Emergency Management, speaking to Barbara Miller. Had a text come through from Brant at a very wet Port Douglas. He says, as the wet season finally arrives in far north Queensland, it's sad to see hundreds of hectares of cane in the Mossman region being sprayed off, dying or rotting in sodden paddocks. He's taken a photo of killed cane just down the road from his house, and he's wondering what sort of large-scale farming will replace it, if ever. That's exactly right, Brant. What's going to happen in the Mossman region, especially with this rain coming through as well? And we'll keep you up to date with the goings on in that region. Our reporter up there, Sophie, recently did a story on some of the work that they're doing to find other crops that can replace the cane that has been grown there for a very, very long time. But up next, new tenants on the Dickey Bill farms, including the one in Queensland in the Wide Bay.
The 2026 Australian Open. Hear it live and ad-free on ABC Sport Digital, and take it with you on the ABC Listen app.
On your radio, online and on the ABC Listen app. This is the Country Hour on ABC Radio Queensland.
So two new businesses have been found to take over the salad farms of Dickey Bill. The company went into administration in December, cutting 180 jobs ahead of Christmas and owing about $10 million to creditors. At the Victoria site, Hussey & Co. will take over the Maffra farm, but they don't plan on reopening the Victorian factory and are seeking just five new farm staff. While in Queensland, Victorian-based Riviera Farms has taken the Drynan Farms property lease near Bundaberg. The company produces a range of salad and vegetable products. Nelson Cox is the managing director. He tells Callie Buchanan they're working towards their planting their winter crop in coming months.
We're a family operation down in East Gippsland in Victoria. We've got various sites in the East Gippsland region that we farm. We're a fifth generation farming family. Originally started off in the dairy industry years ago, and then we've ventured into the vegetable industry, horticulture.
So what do you focus on in horticulture?
We are a mixed operation. Salads would be our main line. We do some hard veg lines as well. Baby broccoli and broccoli. Carrot, baby carrots, yeah.
And do you go broader than Victoria or is Queensland?
We do have an interest in central western New South Wales as well. We do a bit of growing there on share farming, a bit of melon production, yeah.
So what attracted you to the Drynan Farms property?
I guess for the winter climate, we are a 12-month production business and we do struggle now in the winter months with growing. It can get quite cold down in Victoria. So winter time is, I guess, always a challenge for us, and our current customers expect consistent 12-month supply. So I guess that's why we took the opportunity to go to Bundaberg.
So what are your plans in terms of the property? Are you in a position to reopen it?
We are. We've actually started already. We've got two people on site so far, and we're going through the onboarding process of getting some others. We expect to have five there in a couple of weeks. They're previous employees that were there previously, so we're glad to be able to fill that gap, make up a bit for what's happened. Mm.
Do you think you'll be able to take back all of the employees that were put out of work when the previous owner ceased operation?
I guess we'll just have to wait and see. I mean, we've got a bit of a challenge building it, you know, back up again to what it was. We're doing similar lines to what the farm was doing. I'm not overly sure how many were there, so it's a bit hard for me to answer that question, but production-wise, I think we'll get it back to what it was, yeah.
How long do you think that'll take you? Like you mentioned there, obviously, that it's usually a sort of winter harvest. Have you missed a planting window?
No, we won't start planting till end of February, March will be our planting time, so we've still got plenty of time to get our winter program up and going. Yeah, there's a lot to work out there, setting up systems and doing all that stuff. So, yeah, I think we're right to meet the target, yeah.
And you mentioned similar lines, so really focused on that sort of baby leaf salad sort of section?
Yeah, that's what we do now. So it'll be only the baby leaf salad and lettuce, leafy greens that we'll be focusing on, yeah.
I mean, you mentioned there that this does give you year-round opportunity to produce. Is this part of a growth strategy? Do you think Riviera will be looking at maybe doing even more than this?
I think so. I mean, it's going to give us opportunities where we now struggle with production in the wintertime. And, you know, traditionally we have struggled to maintain our market share in the winter. So I think it's going to give us opportunity to be consistent, set our customers' demand, you know, or the expectation is that we are there 12 months of the year with consistent supply. So, I mean, there is the challenges of logistics. It's 2,000 Ks away from where we currently are, so we've got to be mindful. You know, moving stuff around the country is expensive these days, so we need to be mindful how we do it.
And your customers, are they mostly the wholesale markets, or do you sell into the restaurant trade and those sorts of places as well?
We have a mixed clientele, so yeah, wholesale markets, retail and food service, so we've got a pretty broad customer base.
And so you mentioned planting at the end of February into March. Have you had a chance to come up and have a look at the site and see what kind of condition it's in?
Yeah. We've been up a number of times. I mean, obviously the break hasn't done the country that well. It's you get a pretty, with the warm, humid, wet weather, you get a pretty aggressive growth cycle there. So it does need a lot of cleaning up and tidying up, which we've started. We've started that process. So we hope to have it all in shape by that time. So we've been fortunate that we've picked up some some good management. So we're hoping that we'll be ready in time.
I know you mentioned that you don't really know how many staff were there prior, but do you have a ballpark for how many you might need? You said about five?
Five initially, just to get us up and going and growing. But I think once we're up and set up, it'll be around the 30 to 40 staff there through the winter production, because we will do some processing up there as well.
And is there already a capacity to do that processing on site?
There is. The site's set up for that. We'll just have to move machinery up there to set it up. It originally was, the site was originally doing some washing there. So we'll just have to move some machinery back onto the site, get it set up. Hopefully we can turn around what's been a disappointing and continue on the what was started there. It's disappointing what sort of happened, but sadly it's probably a bit of a legacy of what the horticultural industry's gone through in the last 3 years. It's been certainly trying times with rising input costs and compliance. I think the horticultural industry in general's certainly looking for some fresh air. So hopefully we can do that.
Riviera Farms Managing Director Nelson Cox speaking to Callie Buchanan. Had a text come through about earlier story on the funding that's been announced for disaster recovery in the Northwest. They said, I think it was Mervyn said, $38 million doesn't seem much for the Gulf flood disaster, considering the bombs spent $96 million on their website. Now, the $38 million, from what I understand, it's joint funding between the state and federal governments, and it's additional funding to what's already in place for the region. But I will double check that and get back to you if that's not the case. Weather's up next.
Sulugong to serve.
The ABC brings you the story of an icon.
Avon Goolagong.
I know.
Want you to win.
Goolagong.
That's what I'm here for.
Stream all the episodes now on ABC iView.
This is the Country Hour on ABC Radio Queensland.
Time to check in on the weather. Baden Gilbert is on duty at the Bureau of Meteorology. Baden, what's the latest on the weather in North Queensland?
Yes, so currently in North Queensland, we are watching a trough that's sitting from the Gulf of Carpentaria across the base of Cape York Peninsula into the Coral Sea. It's not quite a monsoon trough yet, but there is definitely some monsoonal winds to the north of it passing over Torres Strait and the far north of Cape York Peninsula that are expected to wrap into that trough and make it into a monsoon trough as we go through the next day or so. Embedded in that, out in the Coral Sea, we have a broad area of circulation roughly to the east of Willis Island, so still a fair way offshore, with some pretty decent westerly winds to the north and east to southeasterly winds to the south. And that will be our focus area for a potential tropical low to develop over the next day or so. And that will definitely be a focus for weather for North Queensland as we go into this weekend.
So when can people start to, I guess, expect to start feeling the effects of those two systems?
Yeah, so in terms of the effects that we could see, as we go into this evening, we start to get a risk of heavy rainfall with thunderstorms returning to the North Tropical Coast, roughly from an area around Rollingston up towards Cooktown. That will persist through Thursday. And then as we get into Friday, that risk of heavy rainfall broadens out a bit more, captures a bit more of parts of Cape York Peninsula, maybe it goes a little bit further inland as well. And by that point, we're forecasting this tropical low to be approaching towards the North Queensland coast. So that will definitely be a focus point for that rainfall that we could see from the system as it makes its way towards the coast as we go into Saturday. I suppose the key for this is that there will be two really key focus areas for that rainfall. The first will be on and near this tropical low, as well as on the southern flank of it. That's where we could see the greatest rainfall occurring, where the monsoonal flow is wrapping around the low and pushing into the North Queensland coast. but also definitely a secondary focus area about Torres Strait and areas north of Weipa and places like that. There's definitely a risk of some damaging wind gusts as well as heavy rainfall in that part of the world as we go into this weekend.
So for people in that particular sort of those parts of Queensland, how much rainfall can they expect? Is it going to be like the big, you know, 100, 200 mil falls, or is it going to be that we've sort of seen recently, or is it going to be less or even more than that?
It will really depend exactly where you are, exactly how much rainfall you get, because the focus area of that rainfall from the tropical low could be move around a little bit as we go into this event. The main point I'd want to make as we go through the next couple of days is that particularly from areas from around Cooktown southwards, all the way down as far as even as we go into Saturday and Sunday, as far as the Whitsundays, we couldn't rule out seeing triple figures in 24 hours. And, you know, a fair chunk of that could fall within a 6-hour window. So that's going to be the setup we're looking at as we go into the weekend and continuing even into Sunday. And there is some guidance that keeps a bit of rainfall going for parts of the Queensland coast as we go into Monday even as well, even though there's no, like, we're still not, what's the word? There's only a moderate chance that this system becomes a tropical cyclone, but even if it doesn't, it's still going to be bringing a lot of moisture in and bringing a lot of risk of heavy rainfall that could lead to flooding in with it as well.
Yeah, and as you said, heavy rain, you know, causing flooding, that's something that, you know, we've already sort of seen this month. Mm-hmm. Do you think, I guess, you know, what sort of impact will that have on already sort of flooded systems by the looks of it?
Yeah, indeed. As you say, there's already been quite a bit of rainfall about since roughly Christmas, not just in the northeast of the state, but also in the northwest, where we still have a variety of flood warnings ongoing. Additional rainfall in those catchments will potentially move into the riverine parts of the catchments a bit quicker than it would otherwise. Those saturated catchments can have a bit more flow or runoff into the rivers. So that does mean that everything's a bit more primed to perhaps respond to this rainfall once it starts occurring. So that's definitely something we're considering with our flood watches and flood warnings already in place for some parts of northern Queensland.
So I guess heading away from the north, what can the rest of the state expect in coming days?
Further south, it's actually a bit more of a simpler setup. We do have a pretty solid ridge in place over much of southern Queensland, and that's partly why we're seeing a bit of increase in the activity for northern Queensland, that the winds associated with that ridge are really being squeezed between the ridge and the tropical low. So that's definitely leading to some fresher winds along parts of the central and even into northern Queensland coast during today and through much of the rest of the week, really. But more broadly than that, it's looking pretty dry through the southern and central interior, maybe just some isolated showers about the central and southern coasts of Queensland, a bit more likely right on the coast rather than a bit further inland. But that really sort of sets up the rest of the week with temperatures just sitting a little bit above average about parts of the southwest and southern interior.
And in coastal waters, how are they being impacted by all these, you know, all this unsettled weather and all these different, you know, the trough and the tropical low that's forming? Is it going to increase wind or swells?
Yeah, indeed. So between the ridge and the tropical low, we do have an enhancement in those winds going up parts of the central and northern Queensland coast. We currently have strong wind warnings all the way from the Cairns coast right down to the Capricornia coast. And those sorts of conditions are expected to persist through the rest of this week into this weekend, notwithstanding any impacts that if tropical low 12U does end up becoming a tropical cyclone, we could see additional impacts with the risk of gales associated with that system over waters as well. More broadly, we could just see an uptick in swells about the East Queensland coast through the next couple of days. There's going to be a bit more wind about offshore, so we could see some more easterly swell pushing into places that it doesn't always get to. Should still mostly stay outside the reef for areas further north, but maybe for places around Garee and the Sunshine Coast or even into places around the southern Capricornia could see some eastern swells pick up a little bit as we go through the week into this weekend.
Baden Gilbert, Senior Forecaster at the Bureau of Meteorology.
It's the pointy end of home renovations.
This is brilliant.
Transforming a fixer-upper into the home of their dreams. Share their ups and downs on new Grand Designs Transformations. Starts Thursday, January 8th on ABC TV and ABC iView.
This is the Country Hour on ABC Radio Queensland.
Thank you for your company on the Country Hour today. If you want to join the conversation, you can send me a text 0487 993 222. A North Burnett grower has had some sweet success with his first sugarcane crop. Colston Lakes is about 70 kilometres from the nearest mill, and the land is traditionally used to grow peanuts and grains. Ben Rackerman took a chance on cane as a rotation crop when offered a planting incentive from ICIS Central Sugar Mill. He tells Taylor Larson about his first harvest.
We planted our first crop in March last year, so it had 12 to 18 months of growth, and it was time for it to come out.
How did you find the harvesting process, and logistically, how did that work? Because you are quite away from the mill.
That all went pretty well. So ICIS has infrastructure in place to handle cane away from their site. So they've taken the cane from the Maryborough district. So we're a very similar distance, possibly even a little bit closer than those guys. So we just piggybacked off their infrastructure, their road infrastructure, and then their facilities at the mill to be able to get that to the mill and get it crushed in a timely manner.
How much of your crop was crushed?
A good question, Taylor. You got me a little bit off guard there, a little bit in terms of numbers and things like that. The majority of it was cut for plants in April this year, so there was just a little bit left behind, mainly to just get some numbers in terms of tonnage and sugar content, Taylor. So that was it was more of a trial, more so this year. Next year might be a little bit different. Things are growing really well and look terrific for the season ahead, hey?
Amazing. And with these trial results, how were they?
They exceeded our expectations, I suppose, in terms of sugar. On the day that it was crushed, it met the mill's average, so that was probably better than we thought. Well, we were hoping it would do that, but it ended up being quite good, I suppose, in terms of tonnage. That was pretty damn good too, hey? So, real happy.
How are you feeling going into next year? You said it's looking positive. Traditionally, you guys are in peanuts. So are you hoping, sugarcane can hold up its end?
So we still are peanut farmers and just a little bit of sugar on the side for a bit of a trial. But as I said, with the crush that we've just had, it looks really good, and we've had a really good start to the growing season. So those blocks look terrific at the moment, probably better than some of our other paddocks, like our traditional paddocks of peanuts and things like that. They've taken advantage of early rain. We've had it's over 10 inches in November, so it's taken advantage of that rain and got away to a really good start. So hopefully we'll get some rain over this Christmas period and into the new year, and things will look really good.
Colston Lakes farmer Ben Rackerman speaking to Taylor Larson. It is 17 minutes to one.
You're listening to the Queensland Country Hour on your radio, online, and on the ABC Listen app.
So the European Union has once again delayed the introduction of its anti-deforestation regulation. So that law will now come into effect for larger operators on the 30th of December 2026. So this year, not the 30th of December last year, as it was planned. Now, it requires suppliers to declare if any forest was cleared during the making of their product. In a statement, the EU Parliament said the reason for the delay was to improve the operating system, simplify requirements for smaller operators, and allow those impacted to prepare for the changes. Beef exporter and co-owner of Signature Beef, Josie Angus, tells Claudia Sullivan she wasn't surprised by the delay.
So obviously any technical barriers to trade are always heavily impactful, and this one, was a bit of a doozy, really, in terms of just the ability to do what we need to do in terms of land management, but also to then the impact that it was going to have on supply chains. And I think there wasn't a strong understanding from many people and even some of our industry hierarchy on what this meant in terms of actually demonstrating compliance with the regulation.
Does it feel like this was a law that was created but it wasn't looked into about what would be needed to obey the law.
100%. That's exactly the words I was looking for. But you know, you even had 18 countries from within the EU write to the EU and say this law is something that there's no way that our farmers and food processors can even comply with.
Mm. How did you feel upon the hearing this news? Was it a relief?
It was. I mean, to tell you the truth, I was probably erring on the side of expecting this news once again. I mean, this has been deferred a couple of times. We've seen a lot of opposition, as I said, even out of the EU itself on it. We obviously saw, you know, resistance from many other countries, including America. And it was probably quite disappointing to me, you know, to see that Australia, instead of actually calling out some of the ludicrous elements of the legislation or regulation, once again, we're really quick to throw our own food producers under the bus and say, yep, we can do this, no problem. Yeah.
What is some of the, I guess, miscommunication that's happening there in terms of what you've just said about activists who are frustrated by the definitions there? What is that misunderstanding that's happening?
Yeah, I mean, anyone who believes that you can judge land management by looking at a computer screen has not had a lot to do with land or its management, and that was the reality of what this legislation or regulation set into motion. You know, there was a lot of media that came out of our own industry saying, you know, it's easy, you just tick a box, just put a geolocation on your land and you know, that's all that needs to happen. What was silent was, in fact, what then happened and how the declarations were made by the exporters, you know, to the EU. You know, we had, and even in the kind of the final trial stages that were running in the lead up to the supposed start date, you had land that had been impacted by fire that all of a sudden was being captured in some of this interrogation you know, and that probably really did highlight the ridiculous nature of it.
Josie Angus is a beef exporter and co-owner of Signature Beef. She was speaking there to Claudia Sullivan. Now, just keeping with international trade for a little while longer, marketing and research and development body Meat and Livestock Australia says it's disappointed with China's new global measure on beef imports. So a 55% tariff will apply to all beef imported from Australia this year above the 205,000-ton quota. MLA's General Manager of International Markets, Andrew Cox, spoke to Kim Honan.
I think the future still looks bright in many markets, but of course this will represent a constraint to the demand that we can access within China, and I think that's disappointing for Australian exporters and Australian farmers. I think it's also disappointing for our Chinese customers. We've got fantastic program business that we've developed as an industry with Chinese customers, and as I said before, we've got the trust of Chinese consumers as well. We're known for our quality, for our food safety, nutrition, etc. And of course, from a marketing perspective, we'll keep working with those customers with a long-term view.
So how do you see this playing out globally? We've got 100,000 tonnes of beef that will need to be exported elsewhere. There'll be, you know, other exporters that fill their quota and will have to find other markets as well. Ultimately, are we going to see, you know, exporters really lose out here in Australia?
I think it's important to note that the context here, that the macro sort of environment, trading environment for beef is still very positive. The demand outstrips supply globally. American beef is still in somewhat short supply. So we're exporting very large amounts to North America, Canada. There's opportunities throughout, you know, Southeast Asia with economic growth, et cetera, and wonderful conditions. And once again, a popular product amongst consumers and customers there. We've got opportunities in the Middle East. We've got opportunities in the UK. And hopefully we'll be able to access a free trade agreement with Europe in the coming months, which will also open up another market opportunity for Australian exporters.
And will those importers pay as much as China did for our beef?
Well, it's a competitive space. So, you know, like in all markets, you want as many customers as you can. You don't want to be beholden to any one customer. our industry has done a fantastic job over the years to develop a number of markets. We've got four or five large markets that take a range of cuts, but there's also 20, 30, 40 other markets below that that compete for product. So a wise exporter will make sure that they've got multiple customers for each cut. Of course, whilst trying to set a quota, the quota is still over 200,000 tonnes, which is in line with the five-year average. Of course, it's been recently a little larger to try because the US beef has been sort of cut out of that market. But we never know what will happen in the future. Obviously, the trade dynamic has been a little volatile in the last 12 months. But I think we're accustomed to volatility. If you look over any five-year period in the last 50, you'll have a number of volatile incidents that happen, and that's just how trade works.
Do you think there's any chances that China might change their tune and they may reduce the 55% tariff as the quota starts to fill up?
Yes, I'm not one to speculate on the decision-making of the Chinese authorities, so who knows? I mean, we'll just see how it plays out. We're still in the first week of January. I think there's a bit of discussion to be had between all affected parties, and I know that the Australian government is discussing this issue, this topic, with their counterparts. So obviously we'd hope for relief because, as I said, we believe that we put an extremely strong case forward that any damages to the Chinese cattle industry are not at all caused by our industry. So we'd hope that would be taken into consideration as we go forward.
And have you heard anything from Chinese importers or consumers about how they're feeling?
Yeah, I think the Chinese side, our customers there are working through what this might mean. I think there's still, as we sort of discussed today, there's still a fair few unknowns about how this quota will be managed, or all these quotas will be managed, how they'll be reported, what it means for the product mix that will be going in. A lot of the customers that we have in China are program businesses taking chilled beef for retail shelves, much the same as you might see at Woolworths or Coles. So that sort of requires monthly shipments, and a 55% tariff would create obviously some economic challenges there. So they need to work through what this means for their businesses, and will support each supply chain that's involved in the Australian beef, in importing Australian beef to maximise the potential opportunity for them.
Andrew Cox, General Manager of International Markets at Meat and Livestock Australia.
You're listening to the Queensland Country Hour on your radio, online, and on the ABC Listen app.
You're probably used to hearing heatwave warnings on the Country Hour, especially around this time of the year, but heatwaves also occur in our oceans. And now, for the first time, the Weather Bureau has a way of forecasting those months in advance. Alistair Hobday from the CSIRO has been collaborating with the Bureau of Meteorology as part of its new long-range marine forecasts, which is now available on its website.
We can now look 4 months into the future, and that's a pretty amazing time period to be able to look ahead. You know well that if you're looking ahead at the weather, we trust a weather forecast about 3 to 7 days into the future. We're talking 4 months into the future here now.
So what has happened or gone in to create a modelling system that allows you to look that far ahead?
It's been a collaboration between CSIRO and the Bureau of Meteorology, and it's really the Bureau's underlying weather forecast model that's now got this much high resolution ocean in it, about 25 kilometres resolution, that's really improved our forecasting system.
How does that sort of compare to how far ahead you were able to look into marine heatwaves previously?
Actually, we weren't able to look ahead at all at marine heatwaves. So it really has been a four-year journey to get to this point, and it's only possible because of these high-resolution, what we call coupled ocean atmosphere models.
Our 4 months, as you say, that is a long range, very long-range forecast. So why are you able to see so far ahead in terms of what's happening in the waters as compared to the forecast that you're able to predict on land?
We typically say things like the ocean has a long memory, and it means that heat is retained for longer in the ocean than in the atmosphere. And you know how quickly we can transition from a hot day to a cold day on land. In the ocean, those transitions take a lot longer. And so once an ocean has got a push in a particular direction, it tends to maintain that push for a long period of time. And so our forecasting is our ability to look at where that push will end up 2, 3, 4 months into the future. And so when we see a patch of hot water today, or the conditions that will set up hot water, the model is able to then understand how the physics leads that area to remain warm or become warm 4 months in the future.
So does that give you a pretty high degree of confidence in the accuracy of that forecast, even though it is quite long, you know, perhaps with weather on land being so changeable, does that mean that this is more likely to be quite on the money?
Yeah, we do an evaluation called skill assessment, and that means looking at how the model has performed historically. For example, in January of 1990, how well did we forecast March of 1990, and so on. And that shows us that the forecasting ability varies around Australia, and it's also best only 1 month into the future, a little bit worse at 2 months, a little bit worse at 3 months, and at 4 months, it's still better than an average, but after that, it's not reliable. So we've trimmed these forecasts to be 4 months based on this historical assessment.
This might seem like a stupid question, but a lot of work has gone into this, but why? Why is it useful, and how is it useful to have to be able to forecast marine heat waves 4 months into the future?
Yeah, well, you know well that climate change is warming the oceans around Australia, and that's a long-term change. But on top of that long-term change, we have these very extreme events, like marine heat waves, that can lead to very dramatic changes in the ocean. And so they're much more rapid shocks, a bit like a cyclone on land compared to just a daily breeze. And so if you can look into the future, we can start to think about what we would do differently before this extreme event arrives. If you have information about the future, depending on whether you're a fisherman or running an aquaculture business or a tourism business, you can decide how you're going to modify your business planning because a marine heat wave might be emerging. So in aquaculture, you may decide to harvest your stock early, change the type of animal that you grow, change the feed mix that you provide for it, perhaps implement some disease management if warm waters lead to disease, and so on. In fisheries, there's a similarly long list of things you can do. And even in conservation, there are things like if its exposure to a heat wave is really dangerous for a species, you might decide to rescue it for a short period of time, remove it from the warm waters, and then pop it back in after the summer has passed.
I'm thinking of South Australia, for example. This year, of course, we've been impacted by quite an ongoing and lengthy harmful algal bloom, and the marine heat wave has been linked as part of the factors into why we're seeing this. So would this sort of modelling and having this kind of forecasting also help in perhaps flagging that another one of those might be on its way?
Not every marine heat wave leads to an algal bloom, but many algal blooms are associated with marine heat waves. And so this look in the future would let you decide to pay closer attention to the possibility of an algal bloom, definitely. Now, that might have sounded like a wishy-washy answer, so I'll just say again, yes, in general, information about the future heat of the ocean should let you understand algal blooms more.
CSIRO research scientist Alistair Hobday speaking to Selena Green. Let's head to the Dalby cattle sale, where Errol Luck has the details.
Good afternoon. Dalby Age has been 931 cattle for the first sale of 2026. Most of the usual feeder and restocker buyers attended, along with several processors, with competition strong and the market very similar to the prices obtained at the close of 2025. Yearling steers in the 200 to 280 range to restockers made to 536 to average 519. Yearling steers to feed the domestic market sold to 510 and average 509. And heavy yearling steers to feed made to 506 and average 495. Yearling heifers in the 200 to 330 range to restockers sold to 486 and average 413. Yearling heifers to feed the domestic market made 470, with the heavy yearling heifers to feed at 482 to average 460. Young bullocks to processors averaged 430 and sold to 468. Grown heifers to processors made 436 to average 417. Lightweight plain condition cows to processors made 362 to average 300. Good heavy score 3 cows to processors made 387, with the best of heavy cows at 390 to average 382. Lightweight bulls to feed made to 416 to average 405, and heavy bulls to processors made to 400. This has been Errol Luck, MLA's National Livestock Reporting Service.
That's all we have time for on the Country Hour today. Thank you so much for your company. My name is Megan Hughes. It's coming up to 1 o'clock.